By the time they get to Strawford Park, it's 4:30, and a bunch of girls in yellow Dairy Hardware shirts are on the softball field, all of them with their hair in near-identical ponytails that have been threaded through the backs of their caps. Most have braces on their teeth. "My, my, they flubbin' and dubbin'," Pete says. And maybe they are, but they sure look like they're having fun. Henry is having no fun at all. His stomach is full of butterflies, and he's glad to see Jonesy at least looks the same, solemn and scared. Pete and Beaver don't have a whole lot of imagination between them. He and old Gariella have too much. To Pete and the Beeve, this is just Frank and Joe Hardy stuff, Danny Dunn stuff. But to Henry, it's different. To not find Josie Rinkenhauer would be bad, because they could. He knows they could. But to find her dead... "Beaver," he says. Beaver has been watching the girls. Now he turns to Henry. "What? Do you still think she's alive?" "I..." Beaver's smile fades, and he looks troubled. "I don't know, man. Pete?" But Pete shakes his head. "I thought she was, back at school. Shit, that picture almost talked to me. But now..." He shrugs. Henry looks at Jonesy, who also shrugs, then spreads his hands. "Dunno." So Henry turns to Duddits. Duddits is looking at everything from behind what he calls his ooh-ays. Duddits E's for cool shades, wraparounds with silver-mirrored surfaces. Henry thinks the ooh-ays make Duddits look like Ray Walston in My Favorite Martian, but he'd never say such a thing to Duds, or think it at him. Duds is also wearing Beaver's mortarboard hat. He particularly likes to blow the tassel. Duddits has no selective perception. To him, the wino looking for returnables over by the trash barrels, the girls playing softball, and the squirrels running around on the branches of the trees are equally fascinating. It's part of what makes him special. "Duddits," Henry says, "there's a girl you went to school with at the academy. Her name was Josie Rinkenhauer." Duddits looks politely interested because his friend Henry is talking to him, but there is no recognition of the name, and why would there be? Duds can't remember what he had for breakfast, so why would he remember a little girl he went to school with 3 or 4 years ago? Henry feels a wave of hopelessness, which is strangely mixed with amusement. What were they thinking about? "Josie," Pete says, but he doesn't look very hopeful either. "We used to tease you about how she was your girlfriend, remember? She had brown eyes, all this blonde hair sticking out from her head, and..." He sighs disgustedly. "Fuck." Duddit says. Because this usually makes them smile. Same shit, different day. It doesn't work. So Duddit tries another one.
"No wounce, no lay."
"Yeah," Jonesy said. "No bounce, no play, that's right. We might as well take him home, guys. This isn't gonna..."
"No,"
Beaver says. And they all look at him. Beaver's eyes are both bright and troubled. He's chewing on the toothpick in his mouth so fast and hard that it jitters up and down between his lips like a piston.
"Dreamcatcher," he says.
"Dreamcatcher?" Owen asked. His voice seemed to come from far away, even to his own ears. The Humvee's headlights conned the endless snowy wasteland ahead, which resembled a road only because of the marching yellow reflectors. "Dreamcatcher," he thought, and once more his head filled up with Henry's past, almost drowning him in the sights and sounds and smells of that day on the edge of summer. "Dreamcatcher."
"Dreamcatcher," Beaver says,
and they understand each other as they sometimes do. As they think, mistakenly, Henry will later realize, all friends do. Although they have never spoken directly of the dream they all shared on their first hunting trip to Hole in the Wall, they know Beaver believed that it somehow had been caused by Lamar's dream catcher. None of the others have tried to tell him differently, partly because they don't want to challenge Beaver's superstition about that harmless little string spider web, and mostly because they don't want to talk about that day at all. But now, they understand that Beaver has latched onto at least half a truth. A dreamcatcher has indeed bound them, but not Lamar's. Duddits is their dreamcatcher. "Come on," Beaver says quietly. "Come on, you guys. Don't be afraid. Grab hold of him." And so they do, although they are afraid, A little, anyway. Beaver, too. Jonesy takes Duditz's right hand, which has become so clever with machinery out there at Volk. Duditz looks surprised, then smiles and closes his fingers over Jonesy's. Pete takes Duditz's left hand. Beaver and Henry crowd in and slip their arms around Duditz's waist. And so, the five of them stand beneath one of Strawford Park's vast old oaks, with a lace of June light and shadows dappling their faces. They are like boys in a huddle before some big game. The softball girls in their bright yellow shirts ignore them. So do the squirrels. So does the industrious wino who is putting together a bottle of dinner, one empty soda can at a time. Henry feels the light steal into him and understands that the light is his friends and himself. They make it together, that lovely lace of light and green shadow, and of them all, Duditz shines brightest. He is their ball. Without him, there is no bounce, there is no play. He is their dream catcher. He makes them one. Henry's heart fills up as it never will again, and the void of that lack will grow and darken as the years pile up all around him. And he thinks, is it to find one lost, retarded girl who probably matters to no one but her parents? Was it to kill one brainless bully boy joining together to somehow make him drive off the road, doing it, oh, for God's sake, doing it in our sleep? Can that be all? Something so great, something so wondrous for such tiny matters? Can that be all? Because if it is, he thinks this even in the ecstasy of their joining, then what is the use? What can anything possibly mean? Then that and all thought is swept away by the force of the experience. The face of Josie Rinkenhauer rises in front of them, a shifting image that is composed first of four perceptions and memories, then a fifth, as Duditz understands who it is they're making all this fuss about. When Duditz weighs in, the image grows 100 times brighter, 100 times sharper. Henry hears someone, Jonesy, gasp, and he would gasp himself if he had the breath to do so. Because Duditz may be retarded in some ways, but not in this way. In this way, they are the poor, stumbling, enfeebled idiots, and Duditz is the genius. Oh, my God, Henry hears Beaver cry, and in his voice, there are equal parts of ecstasy and dismay. Because Josie is standing here with them. Their differing perceptions of her age have turned her into a child of about 12, older than she was when they first encountered her waiting outside the retard academy, surely younger than she must be now. They have settled on a sailor dress with an unsteady color that cycles from blue to pink to red to pink to blue again. She is holding the great big plastic purse with Barbie Ken peeking out the top, and her knees are splendidly scabby. Ladybug earrings appear and disappear below her lobes, and Henry thinks, oh yeah, I remember those, and then they steady into the mix. She opens her mouth and says, hi, Duddy, looks around and says, hi, you guys. Then, just like that, she's gone. Just like that, they are five instead of six. Five big boys standing under the old oak with June's ancient light printing their faces and the excited cries of the softball girls in their ears. Pete is crying. So is Jonesy. The wino is gone. He's apparently collected enough for his bottle. But another man has come. A solemn man dressed in a winter parka in spite of the day's warmth. His left cheek is covered with red stuff that could be a birthmark, except Henry knows it isn't. It's virus. Owen Underhill has joined them in Strawford Park, is watching them, but that's all right. No one sees this visitor from the far side of the dream catcher except for Henry himself. Duditz is smiling, but he looks puzzled at the tears on two of his friend's cheeks.
Aye,
he asks Jonesy. Why are you crying? It doesn't matter, Jonesy says. When he slips his hand out of Duditz's, the last of the connection breaks. Jonesy wipes at his face, and so does Pete. Beeve utters a sobbing little laugh. I think I swallowed my toothpick, he says. Nah, there it is, you fag, Henry says, and points to the grass where the chewed-up pick is lying.
Fine horsey,
Duddits asks. Can you, Duds? Henry asks. Duddits walks toward the softball field, and they follow him in a respectful little cluster. Duds walks right past Owen, but of course doesn't see him. To Duds, Owen Underhill doesn't exist, at least not yet. He walks past the bleachers, past third base, past the little snack bar. Then he stops. Beside him, Pete gasps. Duddits turns and looks at him, bright-eyed and interested, almost laughing. Pete is holding out one finger, ticking it back and forth, looking past the moving finger at the ground. Henry follows his gaze, and for a moment thinks he sees something, a bright flash of yellow on the grass like paint, and then it's gone. There's only Pete, doing what he does when he's using his special remembering gift.
Ooh-ee-wee-ay-ay-eat,
Duddits inquires in a fatherly way that almost makes Henry laugh. Do you see the line, Pete?
Yeah, Pete says, bug-eyed. Fuck, yeah.
He looks up at the others.
She was here, you guys. She was right here.
They walk across Strawford Park, following a line only Duddits and Pete can see, while a man only Henry can see follows along behind them. At the north end of the park is a rickety board fence with a sign on it, DB&A, RR Property, Keep Out. Kids have been ignoring this sign for years, and it's been years since the Dairy, Banger, and Aroostook actually ran freights along the spur through the Barrens anyway. But they see the train tracks when they push through a break in the fence. They are down at the bottom of the slope, gleaming rustily in the sun. The slope is steep, a riot with poison sumac and poison ivy, and halfway down they find Josie Rinkenhauer's big plastic purse. It is old now and sadly battered, mended in several places with friction tape, but Henry would know that purse anywhere. Duddits pounces on it happily, yanks it open, peers inside.
I'll be in,
he announces, and pulls them out. Pete, meanwhile, has foraged on, bent over at the waist, grim as Sherlock Holmes on the trail of Professor Moriarty. And it is Pete Moore who actually finds her, looking wildly around at the others from a filthy concrete drain pipe that pokes out of the slope and tangled foliage.
She's in here!
Pete screams deliriously. Except for two flaring patches of color on his cheeks, his face is as pale as paper.
Guys, I think she's in here!
There is an ancient and incredibly complex system of drains and sewers beneath Derry, a town which exists on what was once swampland, shunned even by the Mi'kmaq Indians who lived all around it. Most of the sewer system was built in the 30s with New Deal money, and most of it will collapse in 1985, during the big storm that will flood the town and to destroy the Derry standpipe. Now, the pipes still exist. This one slopes downward as it bores into the hill. Josie Rinkenhauer ventured in, fell, then slid on 50 years' worth of dead leaves. She went down like a kid on a slide and lies at the bottom. She has exhausted herself in her efforts to climb back up the greasy, crumbling incline. She has eaten the 2 or 3 cookies she had in the pocket of her pants, and for the last series of endless hours, 12, perhaps 14, has only lain in the reeking darkness, listening to the faint hum of the outside world she cannot reach, and waiting to die. Now, at the sound of Pete's voice, she raises her head and calls with all of her remaining strength,
Help me! I can't get out! Please! Help me!
It never occurs to them that they should go for an adult, perhaps for Officer Nell, who patrols this neighborhood. They are crazy to get her out. She has become their responsibility. They won't let Duddits in. They maintain at least that much sanity. But the rest of them create a chain into the dark without so much as 30 seconds discussion. Pete first, then the Beeve, then Henry, then Jonesy, the heaviest, as their anchor. In this fashion, they crawl into the sewage-smelling dark. There's the stench of something else, too, something old and nasty beyond belief. And before he's gotten 10 feet, Henry finds one of Josie's sneakers in the muck. He puts it in a back pocket of his jeans without even thinking about it. A few seconds later, Pete calls back over his shoulder.
Whoa! Stop!
The girl's weeping and pleas for help are very loud now, and Pete can actually see her sitting at the bottom of the leaf-lined slope. She's peering up at them, her face a smudged white circle in the gloom. They stretch their chain farther, being as careful as they can despite their excitement. Jonesy has got his feet braced against the huge chunk of fallen concrete. Josie reaches up, gropes, cannot quite touch Pete's outstretched hand. At last, when it seems they must admit defeat, she scrambles a little way up. Pete grabs her scratched and filthy wrist.
Yeah, he screams triumphantly. Gotcha!
They pull her carefully back up the pipe toward where Duddits is waiting, holding up her purse in one hand and the two dolls in the other, shouting in to Josie not to worry, because he's got Barbie Ken. There's sunlight, fresh air, and as they help her out of the pipe... There was no telephone in the Humvee. Two different radios, but no telephone. Nevertheless, a phone rang loudly, shattering the vivid memory Henry had spun between them and scaring the hell out of both of them. Owen jerked like a man coming out of a deep sleep, and the Humvee lost its tenuous hold on the road, first skidding and then going into a slow and ponderous spin like a dinosaur dancing. Holy fuck! He tried to turn into the skid. The wheel only spun, turning with sick ease, like the wheel of a sloop that has lost its rudder. The Humvee went backwards down the single treacherous lane that was left on the southbound side of I-95, and at last fetched up askew in the snowbank on the median side, headlights opening a cone of snowy light back in the direction they had come. Bring, 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 out of thin air. It's in my head, Owen thought. I'm projecting it, but I think it's actually in my head. More goddamn telepath. There was a pistol on the seat between them. A Glock. Henry picked it up, and when he did, the ringing stopped. He put the muzzle against his ear with his entire fist wrapped around the gun butt. Of course, Owen thought. Makes perfect sense. He got a call on the Glock, that's all. Happens all the time. Hello, Henry said. Owen couldn't hear the reply, but his companion's tired face lit in a grin.
Jonesy! I knew it was you!
Who else would it be, Owen wondered. Oprah Winfrey?
Where?
Listening. Did he want Duddits, Jonesy? Is that why... Listening again. Then...
The standpipe? Why?
Jonesy? Jonesy? Henry held the pistol against the side of his head a moment longer, then looked at it without seeming to realize what it was. He laid it on the seat again. The smile had gone. He hung up. I think the other one was coming back. Mr. Gray, he calls him. He's alive, your buddy, but you don't look happy about it. It was Henry's thoughts that weren't happy about it, but there was no longer any need to say this. Happy at first, the way you were always happy when someone you liked gave you a little ringy-dingy on the old Glock, but not happy now.
Why?
They are south of Derry. They stopped to eat at a truck stop called Dysart's. Only Jonesy called it dry farts, like when we were kids. I don't think he even knew it. He sounded scared. For himself? For us? Henry gave Owen a bleak look. He says he's afraid Mr. Gray means to kill a state trooper and take his cruiser. I think that was mostly it. Fuck. Henry struck his leg with his fist. But he's alive.
Yeah, Henry said with a marked lack of enthusiasm. He's immune.
Duddits, you understand about Duddits now?
No, I doubt if you do either, Henry, but maybe I understand enough.
Henry lapsed into thought speak. It was easier.
Duddits changed us. Being with Duddits changed us. When Jonesy got hit by that car in Cambridge, it changed him again. The brain waves of people who undergo near-death experiences often change. I saw a Lancet article on that just last year. For Jonesy, it must mean this Mr. Gray can use him without infecting him or wearing him out. And it's also enabled him to keep from being subsumed, at least so far.
Subsumed?
Co-opted, gobbled up.
Then aloud, "Can you get us out of this snowbank?"
I think so. That's what I was afraid of,
Henry said glumly. Owen turned to him, face greenish in the glow of the dashboard instruments. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Christ, don't you understand? How many ways do I have to tell you this? He's still in there. Jonesy.
For the third or fourth time since his and Henry's run had started, Owen was forced to leap over the gap between what his head knew and what his heart knew.
Oh, I see.
He paused. He's alive, thinking and alive, making phone calls even. He paused again.
Christ.
Owen tried the Hummer in low forward and got about 6 inches before all four wheels began to spin. He geared reverse and drove them backward into the snowbank, crunch. But the Hummer's rear end came up a little on the packed snow, and that was what Owen wanted. When he went back to low, they'd come out of the snowbank like a cork out of a bottle. But he paused a moment with the brake pressed under the sole of his boot. The Hummer had a rough, powerful idle that shook the whole frame. Outside, the wind snarled and howled, sending snow devils skating down the deserted turnpike.
You know we have to do it, don't you? Owen said,
always assuming we're able to catch him in the first place. Because whatever the specifics might be, the general plan is almost certainly general contamination. And the math...
I can do the math, Henry said. 6 billion people on spaceship Earth versus one Jonesy.
Yep, those are the numbers.
Numbers can lie, Henry said, but he spoke bleakly.
Once the numbers got big enough, they didn't. Couldn't lie. 6 billion was a very big number. Owen let off the brake and laid on the accelerator. The Humvee rolled forward a couple of feet this time, started to spin, then caught hold and came roaring out of the snowbank like a dinosaur. Owen turned it south.
Tell me what happened after you pulled the kid out of the drainpipe.
Before Henry could do so, one of the radios under the dash crackled. The voice that followed came through loud and clear. Its owner might have been sitting there in the Hummer with them.
Owen, you there, Buck?
Kurtz. It took them almost an hour to get the first 16 miles south of Blue Base, the former Blue Base, but Kurtz wasn't worried. God would take care of them, he was quite sure of that. Freddie Johnson was driving them. The happy quartet was packed into another snow-equipped Humvee. Pearl Mutter was in the passenger seat, handcuffed to the door handle. Cambry was likewise cuffed in back. Kurtz sat behind Freddie, Cambry behind Pearlie. Kurtz wondered if his two press-ganged laddie bucks were conspiring in telepathic fashion. Much good it would do them if they were. Kurtz and Freddie both had their windows rolled down, although it rendered the Humvee colder than old Dad's outhouse in January. The heater was on high, but simply couldn't keep up. The open windows were a necessity, however. Without them, the atmosphere of the Hummer would quickly become uninhabitable, as sulfurous as a poisoned coal mine. Only the smell on top wasn't sulfur, but ether. Most of it seemed to be coming from Perlmutter. The man kept shifting in his seat, sometimes groaning softly under his breath. Cambry was hot with Ripley and growing like a wheat field after a spring rain, and he had that smell. Kurtz was getting it even with his mask on. But Pearlie was the chief offender, shifting in his seat, trying to fart noiselessly, the one-cheek sneak they had called such a maneuver back in the dim days of Kurtz's childhood, trying to pretend that suffocating smell wasn't coming from him. Gene Cambry was growing Ripley. Kurtz had an idea that Pearlie, God love him, was growing something else. To the best of his ability, Kurtz concealed these thoughts behind a mantra of his own. Davis and Roberts. Davis and Roberts. Davis and Roberts.
Would you please stop that? Cambry asked from Kurtz's right. You're driving me crazy.
Me too, Perlmutter said. He shifted in his seat, and a low pfft sound escaped him. The sound of a deflating rubber toy, perhaps.
Oh, man, Pearlie! Freddie cried.
He unrolled his window further, letting in a swirl of snow and cold air. The Humvee skated, and Kurtz braced himself, but then it steadied again.
Would you please quit with the fucking anal perfume?
I beg your pardon, Perlmutter said stiffly.
If you're insinuating that I broke wind, then I have to tell you
I'm not insinuating anything, Freddy said. I'm telling you to quit stinking the place up, or... Since there was no satisfactory way in which Freddy could complete this threat, for the time being they needed two telepaths, a primary and a backup, Kurtz broke in smoothly.
The story of Edward Davis and Franklin Roberts is an instructive one, because it shows there's really nothing new under the sun. This was in Kansas, back when Kansas really was Kansas.
Kurtz, a pretty decent storyteller, took them back to Kansas during the Korean conflict. Ed Davis and Franklin Roberts had owned similar smallhold farms not far from Emporia, and not far from the farm owned by Kurtz's family, which had not quite been named Kurtz. Davis, never bolted together tightly in the first place, grew increasingly certain that his neighbor, the offensive Roberts, was out to steal his farm. Roberts was spreading tales about him in town, Ed Davis claimed. Roberts was poisoning his crops. Roberts was putting pressure on the Bank of Emporia to foreclose on the Davis farm. What Ed Davis had done, Kurtz said, was to catch him a rabid raccoon and put it in the hen house, his own hen house. The coon had slaughtered those chickens right and left, and when he was plumb wore out with killing, praise God, Farmer Davis had blown Mr. Coon's black and gray striped head off. They were silent in the rolling, chilly Humvee, listening. Ed Davis had loaded all those dead chickens and the dead raccoon into the back of his international harvester and had driven over onto his neighbor's property with them, and by the dark of the moon had chucked his truckload of corpses down both of Franklin Roberts' wells, the stock well and the house well. Then, the next night, high on whiskey and laughing like hell, Davis had called his enemy on the phone and told him what he had done.
"Been pretty hot today, ain't it?" the lunatic had inquired,
laughing so hard Franklin Roberts could barely make him out.
"Which did you and them girls of yours get, Roberts? The coon water or the chicken water? I can't tell you because I don't remember which ones I chucked down which well. Ain't that a shame?"
Gene Cambry's mouth was trembling at the left corner like the mouth of a man who has suffered a serious stroke. The Ripley, growing along the crease of his brow, was now so advanced that Mr. Cambry looked like a man whose forehead had been split open.
"What are you saying?" he asked. "Are you saying me and Pearlie are no better than a couple of rabid chickens?"
"Watch out how you talk to the boss, Cambry," Freddy said. His mask bobbed up and down on his face.
"Hey, man, fuck the boss. The mission is over."
Freddy raised a hand as if to swat Cambry over the back of the seat. Cambry jutted his truculent, frightened face forward to shorten the range.
"Go on, Bubba. Well, maybe you want to check your hand first, make sure there aren't no cuts on it, because one little cut is all it takes."
Freddy's hand wavered in the air for a moment, then returned to the wheel.
"And while you're at it, Freddy, you want to watch your back. You think the boss is going to leave witnesses? You're crazy."
"Crazy, yes," Kurt said warmly and chuckled.
"Lots of farmers go crazy. Or they did then, before Willie Nelson and Farm Aid, God bless his heart. Stress of the life, I suppose. Poor old Ed Davis wound up in the VA. He was in Big Two, you know. And not long after, the thing with the wells, Frank Roberts sold out, moved to Wichita, got work as a rep for Alice Chalmers. And neither well was actually polluted, either. He had a state water inspector out to do some tests, and the inspector said the water was good. Rabies doesn't spread like that anyway, he said. I wonder if the Ripley does."
"At least call it by its right name," Cambry nearly spat. "It's Byrus."
"Byrus or Ripley, it's all the same," Kurt said. "These fellas are trying to poison our wells. To pollute our precious fluids, as somebody other once said."
"You don't care a damn about any of that," Pearlie spat. Freddy actually jumped at the venom in Perlmutter's voice.
"All you care about is catching Underhill."
He paused, then added in a mournful voice, "You are crazy, boss."
"Owen!" Kurtz cried, chipper as a chipmunk. "Almost forgot about him. Where is he, fellas?"
"Up ahead," Cambry said sullenly.
Stuck in a fucking snowbank.
Outstanding, Kurtz shouted. Closing in.
Don't get your face fixed. He's pulling it out. Got a Hummer just like us. You can drive one of those things straight through downtown hell if you know what you're doing, and he seems to.
Shame? Did we make up any ground?
Not much, Pearlie said. Then shifted, grimaced, and passed more gas.
Fuck, Freddy said, low.
Give me the mic, Freddy. Common channel. Our friend Owen likes the common channel.
Freddy handed the mic back on its kinked cord, made an adjustment to the transmitter bolted to the dash, then said,
Give it a try, boss.
Kurtz depressed the button on the side of the mic.
Owen, you there, Buck?
Silence, static, and the monotonous howl of the wind. Kurtz was about to depress the send button and try again when Owen came back, clear and crisp, moderate static but no distortion. Kurtz's face didn't change. It held the same look of pleasant interest, but his heartbeat kicked up several notches.
I'm here.
Lovely to hear you, Bucko, lovely. I estimate you are our location plus about 50. We just passed exit 39, so I'd say that's about right, wouldn't you?
They had actually just passed exit 36, and Kurtz thought they were quite a bit closer than 50 miles. Half that, maybe. Silence from the other end.
Pull over, Buck, Kurtz advised Owen in his kindliest, sanest voice. It's not too late to save something out of this mess. Our career's a shot, no question about that, I guess. Dead chickens down a poison well. But if you've got a mission, let me share it. I'm an old man, son, and all I want is to salvage something a little decent from...
Cut the shit, Kurtz.
Loud and clear from all six of the Hummer's speakers, and Cambry actually had the nerve to laugh. Kurtz marked him with a vile look. Under other circumstances, that look would have turned Cambry's black skin gray with terror. But this was not other circumstances. Other circumstances had been canceled, and Kurtz felt an uncharacteristic bolt of fear. It was one thing to know intellectually that things had gone tits up. It was another when the truth landed in your gut, like a heavy sack of meal.
Owen, laddie, Buck.
Listen to me, Kurtz. I don't know if there's a sane brain cell left in your head, but if there is, I hope it's paying attention. I'm with a man named Henry Devlin. Ahead of us, probably 100 miles ahead of us now, is a friend of his named Gary Jones. Only it's not really him anymore. He's been taken over by an alien intelligence he calls Mr. Gray.
Gary. Gray, Kurtz thought. By their anagrams shall ye know 'em.
Nothing that happened in the Jefferson Tract matters, came the voice from the speakers. The slaughter you planned is redundant, Kurtz. Kill 'em or let 'em die on their own. They're not a threat.
You hear that? Perlmutter asked hysterically. No threat! No...
Shut up, Freddy said, and backhanded him.
Kurtz hardly noticed. He was sitting bolt upright in the back seat, eyes glaring.
Redundant? Was Owen Underhill telling him that the most important mission of his life had been redundant?
Environment, do you understand? They can't live in this ecosystem, except for Gray, because he happened to find a host who is fundamentally different. So here it is. If you ever stood for anything, Kurtz, if you can stand for anything now, you'll stop chasing us and let us take care of business. Let us take care of Mr. Jones and Mr. Gray. You may be able to catch us, but it's extremely doubtful that you can catch them. They're too far south, and we think Gray has a plan, something that will work.
Owen, you're overwrought, Kurtz said. Pull over. Whatever needs to be done, we'll do it together. We'll...
If you care, you'll quit, Owen said. His voice was flat.
That's it. Bottom line. I'm over and out.
Don't do that, Buck, Kurtz shouted. Don't do that. I forbid you to do that.
There was a click, very loud, and then hissy silence from the speaker.
He's gone, Perlmutter said.
Pulled the mic out. Turned off the receiver. Gone. But you heard him, didn't you? Cambry asked. There's no sense in this. Call it off.
A pulse beat in the center of Kurtz's forehead.
As though I'd take his word for anything after what he participated in back there.
But he was telling the truth, Cambry brayed.
He turned fully to Kurtz for the first time, his eyes wide, the corners clogged with dabs of Ripley or the virus or whatever you wanted to call it. His spittle sprayed Kurtz's cheeks, his forehead, the surfaces of his breathing mask.
I heard his thoughts. So did Pearlie. He was telling the stone truth. He...
Once again, moving with a speed that was eerie, Kurtz drew the 9mm from the holster on his belt and fired. The report inside the Humvee was deafening. Freddy shouted in surprise and jerked the wheel again, sending the Humvee into a diagonal skid through the snow. Perlmutter screamed, turning his horrified red-speckled face to look into the back seat. For Cambry, it was merciful. His brains were out the back of his head, through the broken window, and blowing in the storm in the time it might have taken him to raise a protesting hand.
Didn't see that coming at all, did you, Buck? Kurtz thought. Telepathy didn't help you one damn bit there, did it?
No, Pearlie said dolorously. You can't do much with someone who doesn't know what he's going to do until it's done. You can't do much with a crazy man.
The skid was back under control. Freddy was a superior motorman, even when he had been startled out of his wits. Kurtz pointed the 9 at Perlmutter.
Call me crazy again. Let me hear you.
Crazy, Pearlie said immediately. His lips stretched in a smile, opening over a line of teeth in which there were now several vacancies.
Crazy, crazy, crazy.
But you won't shoot me for it. You shot your backup, and that's all you can afford.
His voice was rising dangerously. Cambry's corpse lolled back against the door, tufts of hair blowing around his misshapen head in the cold wind coming through the window.
Hush, Pearlie, Kurtz said.
He felt better now, back in control again. Cambry had been worth that much, at least.
Get a grip on your clipboard and just hush. Freddy?
Yes, boss.
Are you still with me?
All the way, boss.
Owen Underhill is a traitor, Freddy. You can give me a big praise God on that.
Praise God.
Freddy sat ramrod straight behind the wheel, staring into the snow and the cones of the Humvee's headlights.
Owen Underhill has betrayed his country and his fellow men.
He betrayed you, Perlmutter said almost in a whisper.
That's right, Pearlie. And you don't want to overestimate your own importance, son. That's one thing you don't want to do, because you never know what a crazy man is going to do next. You said so yourself.
Kurtz looked at the back of Freddy's broad neck.
We're going to take Owen Underhill down. Him and this Devlin fellow, too, if Devlin's still with him. Understood?
Understood, boss.
Meanwhile, let's lighten the load, shall we?
Kurtz produced the handcuff key from his pocket. He reached behind Cambry, wriggled his hand into the cooling goo that hadn't exited through the window, and at last found the door handle. He unlocked the cuff, and 5 seconds or so later, Mr. Cambry, praise God, rejoined the food chain. Freddy, meanwhile, had dropped one hand into his crotch, which itched like hell. His armpits, too, actually. And he turned his head slightly and saw Perlmutter staring at him, big dark eyes in a pallid red-spotted face.
What are you looking at? Freddy asked.
Perlmutter turned away without saying anything more. He looked out into the night. Chapter 19. The Chase Continues. Mr. Gray enjoyed binging on human emotions. Mr. Gray enjoyed human food. But Mr. Gray most definitely did not enjoy evacuating Jonesy's bowels. He refused to look at what he'd produced, simply snatched up his pants and buttoned them with hands that trembled slightly.
Jesus, aren't you going to wipe? Jonesy asked. At least flush the damn toilet.
But Mr. Gray only wanted to get out of the stall. He paused long enough to run his hands beneath the water in one of the basins, then turned toward the exit. Jonesy was not exactly surprised to see the state trooper push in through the door.
"Forgot to zip your fly, my friend," the trooper said.
"Oh, so I did. Thank you, officer."
"What, come from up north, did you? Big doings up there, the radio says. When you can hear it, that is. Space aliens, maybe?"
"I only came from Derry," Mr. Gray said. "I wouldn't know."
"Oh, what brings you out on a night like this, could I ask?"
Tell him a sick friend, Jonesy thought, but felt a prickle of despair. He didn't want to see this, let alone be a part of it.
"A sick friend," Mr. Gray said.
"Really? Well, sir, I'd like to see your license and register."
Then the trooper's eyes came up double zeros. He walked in stilted strides toward the wall with the sign on it reading, "Showers are for truckers only." He stood there for a moment, trembling, trying to fight back, and then began to beat his head against the tile in big, sweeping jerks. The first strike knocked his Stetson off. On the third, the claret began to flow, first beading on the beige tiles, then splattering them in dark ropes. And because he could do nothing to stop it, Jonesy scrambled for the phone on his desk. There was nothing, either while he had been eating his second order of bacon or taking his first shit as a human being. Mr. Gray had cut the line. Jonesy was on his own. In spite of his horror, or perhaps because of it, Jonesy burst out laughing as his hands wiped the blood from the tiled wall with a Dysart's towel. Mr. Gray had accessed Jonesy's knowledge concerning body concealment and or disposal, and had found the mother lode. As a lifelong connoisseur of horror movies, suspense novels, and mysteries, Jonesy was, in a manner of speaking, quite the expert. Even now, as Mr. Gray dropped the bloody towel on the chest of the trooper's sodden uniform — the trooper's jacket had been used to wrap the badly bludgeoned head — a part of Jonesy's mind was running the disposal of Freddie Miles' corpse in The Talented Mr. Ripley, both the film version and Patricia Highsmith's novel. Other tapes were running as well, so many overlays that looking too deeply made Jonesy dizzy, the way he felt when looking down a long drop. Nor was that the worst part. With Jonesy's help, the talented Mr. Gray had discovered something he liked more than crispy bacon, even more than binging on Jonesy's well of rage. Mr. Gray had discovered murder. Beyond the showers was a locker room. Beyond the lockers was a hallway leading to the trucker's dorm. The hall was deserted. On the far side of it was a door which opened on the rear of the building, where there was a snow-swirling cul-de-sac, now deeply drifted. Two large green dumpsters emerged from the drifts. One hooded light cast a pallid glow and tall, lunging shadows. Mr. Gray, who learned fast, searched the trooper's body for his car keys and found them. He also took the trooper's gun and put it in one of the zippered pockets of Jonesy's parka. Mr. Gray used the blood-stained towel to keep the door to the cul-de-sac from latching shut, then dragged the body behind one of the dumpsters. All of it, from the trooper's gruesome induced suicide to Jonesy's re-entry to the back hall, took less than 10 minutes. Jonesy's body felt light and agile, all weariness gone, at least for the time being. He and Mr. Gray were enjoying another burst of endorphin euphoria. And at least some of this wet work was the responsibility of Gary Ambrose Jones. Not just the body disposal knowledge, but the bloodthirsty urges of the id under the thin candy frosting of "It's Just Make-Believe." Mr. Gray was in the driver's seat. Jonesy was at least not burdened with the idea that he was the primary murderer. But he was the engine. "Maybe we deserve to be erased," Jonesy thought as Mr. Gray walked back through the shower room, looking for blood splatters with Jonesy's eyes and bouncing the trooper's keys in one of Jonesy's palms as he went. "Maybe we deserve to be turned into nothing but a bunch of red spores blowing in the wind. That might be the best thing, God help us." The tired-looking woman working the cash register asked him if he'd seen the trooper.
"Sure did," Jonesy said. "Showed him my driver's license and registration, as a matter of fact."
"Been a bunch of Mounties in ever since late afternoon," the cashier said. Storm or no storm, they're all nervous as hell. So's everyone else.